This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, yeet. We're talking about the new words Merriam-Webster just added to their dictionary. Find out what makes a word stand the test of time with the hosts of the public radio show Away With Words. Now, former President Donald Trump held a rally in Ohio this past Saturday in which a song was played that many say sounds like a theme song of the QAnon conspiracy movement called WWG1WGA, abbreviated from the QAnon slogan, "Where we go one, we go all." Trump's supporters responded to the song by holding up a finger alluding to the word one from the slogan. Trump has recently been sharing QAnon-themed messages on Truth Social, his social media platform. QAnon is complicated. It's an American political conspiracy theory often believed by political members of the far right. It started mostly in 2017, an effort to claim that Trump is fighting against a widespread pedophile movement. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this conspiracy theory online among people you know, family members? How much of an impact do you see it having, maybe on American politics? What do you think of the idea of the former president now more or less actively promoting the conspiracy theory? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa Deckman is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and a political scientist who studies the impact of gender, religion, and age on public opinion and political behavior. Melissa, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I gave a very basic outline of QAnon. Can you tell us a little more about what goes into this conspiracy theory?
Sure. So my research institute, PRI, began tracking whether or not Americans could be classified as followers of QAnon. And essentially, we basically boil it down to three core beliefs. So folks who are QAnon believers believe that the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. They also believe that a storm is coming soon that will sweep away the elites in power and restore rightful leaders to the country. And lastly, they endorse political violence. We have a question where we ask Americans, because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. To what extent do you believe that? What we find is that when we take those three elements together, it really actually provides a pretty accurate estimate of who would be classified as someone who would be a QAnon follower. And we find in our research, we started tracking this back in March of 2021. And most recently, we did a big report in March of this year. We find that about 18% of Americans can be classified as someone who believes in QAnon.
This centered around the role of then President Trump in many ways, and many of the specific claims that came out of this theory offered specific dates where, as you mentioned, the storm would come, where President Trump would arrest, possibly execute a lot of high-ranking officials, Democrats in particular. Those days, of course, came and went. Those things didn't happen. And yet in your surveys, you find the conspiracy theory itself didn't dwindle after that.
No. In fact, we were maybe a little bit surprised just how entrenched it's become among some Americans. I think with conspiracy theories, these are obviously unfounded in reality. There's really no proof. But our research finds that Americans who tend to adopt them surround themselves with other people who have those theories, but they also watch media sources that also tend to reinforce those ideas. So if your steady stream of information is that these things are true and you're hearing it repeatedly during the day and you have political leaders that you emulate are saying it, then I think it's hard to get out of that bubble where you're just being fed this disinformation.
Now, with some conspiracy theories, flat earth or moon landing things or things like that, like if you believe them, you're wrong, but maybe no harm done, right? I mean, it's not going to change your behavior in the world. Do you have concerns that something like a movement like QAnon is going to have real world consequences?
Absolutely. This is the real threat that we're facing in terms of our democracy. The link here, I think, that worries us and worries many Americans who follow this is the resort to violence aspect of this. Because when you suddenly have a group of Americans who think it's legitimate to use political violence to overturn the results of an election they think were stolen from a political leader, that is really cause for concern. And we see in many Republican races across the country, not all by any means. And I should indicate that most Republicans are not QAnon believers. But there are some Republicans who won primaries who really do, in fact, embrace these theories. And I think we're setting up a situation in some states where if those folks, for example, lose the general election in the fall, or actually if they win the election and then future elections, for example, for the presidency in 2024, indicate that the Republican doesn't win, are they going to overturn those elections? And will they use violence to try to set that those kinds of activities in place? And so that's really where the threat is in terms of our democracy.
Talking to Melissa Deckman from the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the QAnon conspiracy theory and former President Trump more openly promoting it in recent weeks. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melissa, the role of the former president here during his term in office, there was a thought that he kind of kept this Q movement at arm's length, only referred to it obliquely. There are reports that at his rallies, people were encouraged to actually cover up any Q-related paraphernalia. Now we have him nodding at a rally, playing music related to the movement, posting on his social media sites, sharing openly QAnon posts with the phrases, you know, the storm is coming, and other trademark hallmarks of the conspiracy. What do you make of that change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty remarkable that he played this song that's affiliated with QAnon at the rally. But one analysis by the Associated Press found over the last month of nearly 75 accounts that Trump has reposted on his social truth media website, Truth Social rather, about a third of those posts have promoted QAnon movement slogans, videos, or imagery. So we've moved from sort of the wink and nod that I think Trump used to do with respect to QAnon prior to the 2020 election to a more open embrace of it. And I think it's happening for two reasons. One, he's in a lot of legal jeopardy right now. And if you'll notice, in the past couple of weeks, he's been given media interviews where he's essentially said, if the FBI or if the Justice Department actually goes through and prosecutes him, he's basically saying that there are a group of citizens who will react in a way that is violent. So I think he's sending a message that don't prosecute me because I have people who are here who will essentially have his back. I think secondly, though, Donald Trump still, I think, the most popular figure within the GOP. He still has a strong base of support among Republicans. But there are certainly political leaders looking to run for president in his party. I think of someone, of course, probably most famously, someone like Ron DeSantis. So I think he's trying to ward off potential folks to run against him in the 2024 election. So those are the two factors, I think, that has led Donald Trump, in fact, to be more open in his embrace of QAnon, because QAnon supporters are probably the most loyal Trump followers out there today.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hello.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for this segment. I heard the 18% figure that the guest shared, and that's frankly terrifying to me that significant that large of a chunk of the population is willing to do violence. And I guess I was wondering if the guest has any insight into the question of sort of how such a sizable segment of the population bought into something that is, frankly, so ludicrous.
Michael, thanks for that call. Melissa, what do we know, what don't we know about why many people, as Michael says, have bought into this movement?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think it kind of gets into larger questions about why people adopt conspiracy theories in general. I think part of it lies in the fact that we did a deeper dive into looking at folks who believe QAnon and what they're like. A lot of QAnon believers, I think, tend to have lots of what we might call cultural grievances, right? They look at the way that America is changing in terms of race, in terms of less religious believers, in terms of all these other larger threats in society, the growth, for example, in the number of Americans who identify as LGBTQ+, all these sorts of things are viewed as, I think, threats to them. And so I think for some people, looking to a source like QAnon gives them some sort of hope and makes some sort of sense for them in the world. And it's just really often difficult to disabuse people of conspiracy theories, especially if they remain entrenched in those social media sites where they're hearing the same untruths happen over and over again.
Thanks for that call. Melissa, you're at an outfit that studies religion in particular, and it sounds like there is almost a religious as much of a political attachment to this conspiracy theory in some ways.
I think that there's certainly some overlap, right? If you had a Venn diagram of what we might call Christian nationalists, and these are Americans who believe that we need to have almost a theocracy return, you know, or it have sort of conservative Christians remain in power and make laws that sort of reemphasize those ideologies. There is some overlap between strong Christian nationalist beliefs and QAnon believers. But it's not merely, I think, a religious movement in and of itself. Certainly, I do think that there are some correlations between those two things.
We're talking to Melissa Deckman, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, about the impact former President Donald Trump has on promoting the conspiracy theory QAnon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think QAnon is a serious threat? Do you know anyone who believes in QAnon that you're maybe worried about? What do you think about the former president now more openly supporting the conspiracy theory? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Melissa Deckman, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Melissa's talking with us about the impact former President Trump has on encouraging the QAnon conspiracy theory movement, especially after a series of pro-QAnon posts promoted by the former president on his social media site. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this conspiracy theory and those who believe it, the impact on politics it has, or do you have thoughts? Have you had encounters with that among your coworkers, maybe family members or people you know online, for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts or your questions. Melissa, as you mentioned, you were surprised to see the persistence of these ideas into 2021, 2022. Now we have, again, the former president who is, you know, the star in some ways of this conspiracy theory as designed by those promoting it, now actually communicating with it, promoting it in some ways. What are you watching for to see what kind of impact that then has on belief in this theory?
You know, it's interesting to see Trump sort of switch to a more overt embrace of QAnon. And I think there's possibly, you know, I'm thinking that it might even have a little bit more of a backlash. Again, we find that roughly 18% of Americans basically fall into this category of QAnon believers. It's a minority of the country. And I think that by embracing it, you know, the reality is that most Americans don't accept it. And so I think potentially this might even signal that Trump is in sort of a weaker state than he was certainly going into the 2020 election. So I think there's a potential for a backlash to this. And it might even play into the hands, I think, of some of his rivals within the Republican Party who are seeking that nomination in 2024.
Now, when I talked to one of your colleagues about the survey that's providing some of our data here, an interesting point was you were looking at the beliefs attached to it, not asking directly, are you a follower of this conspiracy theory? It's not so much the brand as the beliefs you've been following. Do you think that fewer people might say, yeah, I follow this theory versus I hold these beliefs that line up with this theory?
That's a very, very good point. You know, it's really hard in a survey to say, do you follow QAnon? Because we'd find essentially that many Americans probably wouldn't say yes. And so our research team actually went on QAnon sites and were looking for language and common themes that they saw on those sites. And that was really the basis of the questions that we asked. And so in putting that together, I think it actually holds together as a pretty good scale. But I do think also in terms of political violence, I think the problem is it's not that we're necessarily going to be seeing 18% of Americans tomorrow going and storming the Capitol, although frankly, with January 6th, we did see a lot of the folks who stormed the Capitol in January 6th, the insurrection, were linked to QAnon and having those beliefs. But it's more that, are we allowing, you know, certain political leaders to justify certain undemocratic principles going forward? I mean, I think that's really kind of the challenge. and where we go in the future when you're allowed to justify these sorts of undemocratic principles. And that's, I think, where we really want to keep track of where this movement is headed, certainly.
And then looking at your data, can you tell us a little more about what we know about who finds these QAnon ideas most appealing?
Sure. So we find that, for example, the biggest indicator of denoting whether someone is what we would call a QAnon follower or holds those QAnon sort of beliefs are linked to media sources. So if you follow OANN or Newsmax, some of these far right news sources, you're far more likely to believe in QAnon or to embrace some of the ideas that QAnon purports. We find education is strongly linked. So if you are high school degree or less, you're more likely to be someone who subscribes to some of these QAnon beliefs. We also find Republicans more than the Democrats and independents are more likely to believe those things as well.
We heard from Kurt in Elgin, Illinois, who couldn't stay on the line, wonders if we know how many police officers in Wisconsin or around the U.S. are members of QAnon. I don't remember off the top of my head if you looked specifically at different professions, Melissa, in this survey.
Yeah, that's a great question. Unfortunately, we didn't ask about people's professions. But, you know, I do think that there is a concern about the role of sheriffs in some more conservative communities. I haven't really seen any data on whether they purport to believe QAnon theories per se, but there is a growing concern that some sheriffs might be willing to embrace tendencies toward, you know, some of those, the idea that the election was stolen from Donald Trump and those sorts of things. So that's actually a really good question we should look into, definitely.
Talking to Melissa Deckman, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the QAnon conspiracy movement, the former president, Donald Trump, supporting it now more, at least in posts on his social media site, and some of the demographics and the research into who follows the beliefs of this conspiracy theory. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa, do you see, I don't know, social issues leading people maybe to turn towards something like QAnon? You were starting to touch on this a little earlier, resentment over things like inequities in society or suspicion of elites, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of suspicion of elites, I think we see that and those kind of cultural threats. I think the other thing, too, is that there's a big debate in this country about gender identity. And I think that we have a younger generation of Americans who are more racially diverse, religiously diverse, or less religious, but also willing to identify as LGBTQ. And I think it's interesting that we see, for example, on far-right media sources, and we see in school boards across the country, concerns about how to deal with gender identity. And so I think it's important. One of the questions we ask about is this idea of pedophilia. And if you'd asked me, you know, decades ago as a survey researcher, we'd be asking Americans if they agree the U.S. was controlled by Satan worshiping pedophiles. I would have said that's pretty ludicrous. But I do think that this idea that we have, you know, people grooming children in public schools to embrace these alternative gender identities, you see that happening a lot on certain media outlets. And I think that that's where you see that language potentially appealing to some people that who maybe ahead of this time would never have embraced these sorts of beliefs that are not at all grounded in fact.
Yeah. Do you see some of these ideas finding their way more and more into the mainstream, even if they're not expressed quite as openly?
Well, I think that it's maybe not in the mainstream per se, but I do think that you know, it's an attempt to sort of recast violence against Democrats, LGBT people, as defending children, right? And normalizing this kind of ideology. And that's the part that I think that is really, really troubling.
In our last couple of minutes, you've done surveys in the past. What kind of research are you looking to in the future to follow the spread of this idea, see how it morphs, changes, declines, or increases?
Sure. We're certainly going to be, I think, for the near future, looking at these ideas about QAnon beliefs, certainly. But we're also expanding into Americans' ideas about democracy, the health of our democracy. We have at PRI an initiative where we're calling it, in fact, Religion Renewing Democracy, but we are growing concerned about these undemocratic values that are being embraced by people. The idea, for example, that resorting to violence would be necessary to save our country is something that we're certainly keeping our eye on, because it is a challenge to the health of our democracy in the future.
It's easy for a conspiracy theory to spread. Melissa, do you see ways to spread more pro-democracy, anti-violence ideas in a positive way?
Yeah, I think that's sort of the question that many researchers and political scientists and people who care about the health and safety of our democracy are really concerned about right now. I think the unfortunate thing is that it's hard lifting. It's a hard lift in the sense that there is a way to combat this misinformation, but it's often through meeting other people who are different from you, right? Who hold different views, and sort of demystifying what people are on the other side of the political aisle. I mean, unfortunately, we live in a political time, it seems, where partisanship has become a social identity, right? And we are defining the other side as being inherently, not good people, and we're not trusting what other people are saying. And those sorts of relationships really can be rebuilt by kind of taking time to meet other people who aren't like you. That's hard to do. It's effective. It's hard to do. But that, I think, is the great challenge we face here in American democracy and society overall.
Melissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Melissa Deckman, the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and political scientist who studies the impact of gender, religion, and age on public opinion and political behavior. She joined us today to talk about former President Trump's connection with the conspiracy theory QAnon. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's a look at beer through the ages. Start off with a look at the state of small breweries in Wisconsin, a brewer's round table, as I understand it. You can get started on that right now if you're a brewer yourself or a fan of someone's work. Share your thoughts. Email right now at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's beers of the present and future. Then dig deep into the archaeology of prehistoric beer, one of the oldest signs of human civilization, as I understand it, brewing. So it's all things beer, past and present. Again, join in with your favorites. Email ideas@WPR.org. And then join that conversation coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you spend time outside at all, there's a good chance you see ants pretty often. And hey, sometimes ants show up inside too. And it can seem like there are a lot of ants out there. But like, how many are there on planet Earth? Well, now we have an answer, or at least an estimate. According to a new Nature survey published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, there are 20 quadrillion ants on this here planet. So I had to think about that. Quadrillions, right? You've got ones, thousands, millions, billions, trillions, then you hit quadrillions. A quadrillion is a one with 15 zeros. Now take that times 20 and there's ants. Or take a trillion, then think about 20,000 of those. Long story short, it's a lot of ants. I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. It's science news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett. Now, dictionaries change from year to year. They're living documents. Merriam-Webster recently released their new batch of 370 words and definitions that it says have cemented themselves in popular usage to the point that they're worthy of being added to their dictionary. How does that process actually work? Who makes the call? For some words, does getting printed in the dictionary make them less cool somehow? We're going to get some answers and talk about some of these quote-unquote new words, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look forward to when these new words come out? An interesting point of curiosity for you. Have you seen some of the latest on the list? Is there a word that's new to you, dictionary or not, that you've come across in slang or technology or food? hot or not? Do you like the word or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And is there a word that you use maybe in your family or your workplace that's maybe unique to you and your local circle, but it serves a purpose? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett are co-hosts and co-producers of the radio show A Way with Words. You can hear them every Sunday morning at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Martha's written books on word origins and has a background in ancient Greek and Latin. Martha, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Rob.
And Grant is a lexicographer and linguist specializing in slang and new words. Grant, good to talk to you again.
Hello.
Martha, okay, the dictionaries, they do this every year, sometimes more often, these new words. I grew up, I think I thought the dictionary was the rule book, right? These are the words we have, mm-hmm. the English language. These are the ones you can use. That's not really how it works. It's kind of a reflection of a changing language, right?
Exactly. That's a great word, reflection, because the dictionary just reports what's out there. It's more like, we used to have phone books. I guess we don't really have them anymore, but it's more like the phone book than the social register, you know, telling you what you should and shouldn't use. It's a record of how we speak.
And Grant, you've done some work actually producing dictionaries. What can you tell us about the process of determining whether a word makes the cut?
Oh, I could talk for hours about it, but in brief...
He has.
Yeah.
I have.
He does.
The brief version of it is, it's a very thoughtful process. It's a lot of very bright people spending a huge amount of time, like more time than you can possibly imagine, reading and discussing and gathering data and really thinking about what the public would want to look up. And so they read a wide variety of subject matter. They record all the new uses and all the new words that they find. They put them in databases. Sometimes they record them in physical files. For example, Merriam-Webster has a physical file card catalog of more than 15 million cards that you can see if you visit their campus. And then when it comes time to update the dictionary, they go through and say, well, where are we? What's happening in the world right now, or where in the alphabet are we? And they go through and they say, well, this is happening and this is happening. And in that way, these incredibly bright and thoughtful people, I mean, this is not something that they take lightly, put these words on the table and argue with a passion that you cannot imagine. I mean, and humor and grace and goodwill about what should be included. And so every word that is included in these new words list is the product of this a spirited process, a generous process. And trust me when I say that these people who put this together, it's a battle. It's a win and a loss every time a word does and doesn't make it.
We'll talk more about the process, but I want to get a taste of some of these new words in the dictionary. And Martha, yeah, let's get a taste of some of the food-related words they've added. Now, here's one. It's two words that were already there, pumpkin and spice, but they're now defining pumpkin spice as a definable phrase. Could you talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, they are indeed, right? For better or for worse. It seems like that just came out of nowhere a few years ago. And now, you know, it's something that you expect, especially in October. Another food word that caught my eye, that or a food term that's recently been added to the dictionary, is oat milk, because that is what we call in language a retronym. It's a new term for an existing object or idea to distinguish it from a later development or invention. Like, for example, you know, we used to just talk about guitars, and now we talk about electric guitars and acoustic guitars. Or we talk about, you know, we used to talk just about radio, but now you have clock radios and car radios. So now also you have soy milk, almond milk, oat milk. And another retronym that was recently added that's not exactly food related, but it's meat space. You know this one, right?
Meat space is, as opposed to like being on a virtual meeting, right? We're in a place particular, right? Do I have that roughly right?
Yeah, meat space is the real physical world.
Okay.
It's the world of flesh and blood, as opposed to cyberspace. And meat space has been around since the early 1990s or so. So yeah,
oh, yeah.
Rob, we might say, you know, let's get together with Grant in meat space. So we're not online. We're actually in a coffee shop.
I feel like that was in Rocky Balboa in a butcher's.
Right. Well, that could be a meat space in a meat space, definitely.
Yeah, it could be.
Now that's, I feel like that was around an early cyberpunk writing, right? And so, Grant, what's with the time lag there? A phrase that's been around for a long time could take a long time to end up rising to a dictionary's attention.
Yeah, that's what I was saying about dictionary editors and lexicographers being very careful. They don't really jump the gun. Sometimes they're accused of putting these fly-by-night words in there, but the best lexicographers don't do that. They wait. A word has to prove itself. It has to show up for a long period of time across a wide variety of media used across a large spectrum of society, and it really needs to... It really has to have legs, as they say. That's one of my favorite expressions. It has to really show itself. I look at something, speaking of retronyms, something like dumbphone. How long have we been saying smartphone? Well, dumbphone is a retronym of smartphone. It's a phone that is modern but doesn't have any of the smartphone features, and that has been around forever. Even a term like shrinkflation has been around for a while, but it had to prove itself. And it wasn't included just because it's become more commonly known in recent years, because it's not new. Even janky, which is on this year's Merriam-Webster list, dates to the 1960s. Janky meaning trashy or broken or badly made. So it really has got to show endurance, longevity.
We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from A Way with Words, looking at a batch of new words that entered, in this case, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, but also how words start and enter a language. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Clem is with us in Portage. Clem, hi.
Well, good afternoon. How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Clem?
Well, I got an e-nuke word for you. It's very, especially e-nuke word, which means unique. But since everybody's modifying the word unique, I figured I would make up a new word to mean absolutely, solitarily unique, which is, of course, the meaning of the word.
Clem, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Unique, I think people talk about it being watered down, like it could be, you know, comparatively unique. It's not one of a kind, but close. Now, Clem's trying to coin something. Martha, can we make Inuk a thing?
Like
Fetch. It worked for Fetch, right?
Can we make Inuk? That's a cozy place to read your ebook, isn't it? An Inuk?
Clem makes a good point that a lot of people use the term unique and add the very to it, which sort of changes the meaning a little bit, but that's pretty much entrenched in the language now. You know, I mean, sticklers will say if something's unique, it's the only thing like it in the universe. Or the metaverse, or the multiverse. I think maybe you would need one of those compound German words with lots of syllables. I think he was starting down that path. Solitary, absolutely unique.
Definitely. Clem, thanks for that call. Now, he's trying to coin, I think, a slang term, Grant. And I understand you are I seem to recall you're a big fan of slang terms entering the language. You mentioned janky as one of those. Anything else on the new list hitting you from the world of slang?
Well, you know, I'm going to call her out, but your producer, Sarah, said that she uses yeet, even though she's 29, and I hardly endorse
She's not
yeet.
Lying.
And yeet's another one of those. It's older than you think. It's from at least as early as 2007 as an interjection expressing surprise or approval or enthusiasm. And then it was turned into a verb because you would shout it as an interjection when you would throw something. So now it means to throw. And it's kind of the opposite of yoink, which means to take something suddenly. And it's weird because we all thought, I say we, meaning people who studied the changing lexicon, we all thought it was just going to burn out as fast as something like bling bling dig, but it really looks like it might stick around for a while because it's still lurking. Martha and I just did a school visit in Huntsville, Alabama, and it turned up on a bunch of the cards of slang submitted by the high school kids there. So they're not done with it yet.
We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, co-hosts and co-producers of the radio show A Way with Words. Check it out on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. And we're talking about new words being added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary and other dictionaries. We're also talking about how words make it into language in the first place, too. They get yeeted into the language. Is that Sarah? Thumbs up? No. Yeah, okay, great. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered a word that was new to you recently? Friend or foe, did you like it or not? Do you have questions for our guests about words and how they come to be in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, here now with co-hosts of A Way with Words, Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, talking about word origins and new dictionary words after Merriam-Webster announced the latest edition, 370 new words and definitions. Go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us now in Eau Claire. Valerie, hi.
Hello. The word I'm looking at is scrum. So my daughters both played rugby, and the scrum is when the group works together to move the ball. Well, one of the daughters is now working for a company, and she is a scrum manager for her group of coworkers.
And I'm guessing, Valerie, that doesn't mean that her business has a rugby team. It means something completely different, right?
It means completely different that she is, I mean, it's still a group working towards a common goal. But that's the first time I had ever heard anything in business as being a scrum manager.
Interesting. Valerie, thanks a lot for that call. Martha, as I think about it, I guess this probably happens. You know, we might huddle up at a team meeting at a workplace. Sometimes phrases go from the sports world to business and elsewhere.
Yeah, how interesting. I mean, how interesting. Think about baseball, for example. There's so many terms that have been adopted into the business world and elsewhere from baseball, you know, hitting a home run, for example, or touching all the bases. Scrum manager is a new one on me. Have you heard it, Grant?
Yeah, it's part of a project management methodology that it really started to take hold in Silicon Valley and then those sorts of businesses. And it involves certain kinds of principles that I won't get into here about how to manage a process of developing a project so that all parts of the project are respected and all people in the process get their due. So that it's not a top-down process, it's a through-and-through process. I mean, I know that I've shorted it and scrum managers are now shouting it through radio, but it's an established project management philosophy, which you can buy books on and get training in.
As Valerie was talking, I was looking up Scrum Master, and I got to say the descriptions I'm seeing are using a language that I identify as English, but very much corporate speaker.
If you know Six Sigma and all that stuff from back in the day, it's reminiscent of that. You sometimes wonder if it isn't selling shovels to the gold miners. It's more about the getting paid to teach the training than it is about actually getting the training that go well, if that makes sense.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for that call, Valerie, at 800-642-1234. Kevin joins us next in Viroqua. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
What words do you have for us today, Kevin?
Well, one from each side of the family. My mother's side used a term, and it was slaunch-wise. I don't know how she spelled it. But it referred to slaunch-wise was anything that's kind of cockeyed, especially if Dad was lying diagonally on the bed. He was sleeping slaunch-wise. And the other is febble, F-E-B-B-L-E, referring to small, fluttering white moths that annoy people inside the house. That's from my wife's side of the family, the febble.
Unique to your family, Kevin. Martha, I dimly remember, did we talk one time about sort of those unique words that we have in our own little communities, whether it's a family or group of friends or something like that? Is that something that a lot of people do?
Oh, of course. Yes, I think every family has its own language and own code and words that are invented by children, for example, and you just keep saying them because they're just so cute and they're little souvenirs of their childhood once they get older. Febbles is the word? Feffert or Febble?
Febble was the little fluttering insect that we don't know the name of for real, I guess. Yeah.
Boy, I don't know that. It reminds me of Greebles, which are those little things, those little balls of lint in your pockets.
Wait, there's actually a word for the little balls of lint in my pocket?
I believe there is.
Greebles? Oh, that's also the name of what cats seem to be chasing when they go crazy in the house and you can't see what the invisible spirits are that they're looking at and nobody else can see. Greebles.
Wait, oh, those are greebles, not febbles.
yeah, greebles.
And then the other word, slaunchwise, has been around for a while. That's
oh, really?
A dialectal term that has to do with something being slanted or off. A lot of people use the word catawampus or antigoglin or psigoglin, but they're all words for something that's kind of askew, you know, like a picture frame that's not quite hung correctly.
Yeah, it's got about 200 years history in the United States, slaunchwise.
So, Kevin, that one, I think it was your mother-in-law, isn't making it up. She's actually got a way with words. We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from A Way with Words. Check them out on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. We're talking about new words entering the language, entering the dictionaries, and you are sharing yours at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Hayward. Hi, Steve. Oop, are you there, Steve?
Hello.
Yeah, go for it, Steve. Yes. What's your word for us today?
My word is E-E-W-E. It's spelled I-I-W-I-I, and it stands for it is what it is.
Oh, okay. And is this is something that you say to other people?
Yeah, as far as I know, I made it up. And
okay.
Because we were in a circumstance where we needed to, someone said this so often that we shortened it to E-E-W-E. And so it was a little snarky, but... I was just curious. I listen to your program on Sundays and love it. And just curious if you've heard of this before or if, in fact, I did make it up.
Okay. So, first of all, that particular word acronym, I guess, Martha and Grant, and also is this a pretty common way that words happen, that they're, in the case of E-E-W-E, abbreviations like that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the one that comes to mind for me is WYSIWYG, you know, what you see is what you get, or wombat. Which is a waste of money, brains, and time. I mean, I think some of those, it's just easier to say the abbreviated version, and I'm certainly going to adopt E-E-W-E. Makes perfect sense to me.
A quick Google turns up a few places where people have used it, and it actually looks like somebody has trademarked it, but
uh-oh.
I don't let that stop you.
Yeah, just keep it on the down low, Steve. Don't call into public radio shows and admit that you're using that trademark phrase, whatever you do. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. How about Laura next in Madison? Laura, hi.
Hi. I was calling about the word biweekly or bimonthly, and it always bothered me. What gives? I mean, it's so confusing. And the same thing with winterize. Sometimes it means close down for the winter. Other times it means adapt for the winter. So why is that?
Well, I'm guessing Laura is the only person who's ever had a problem with bimonthly and biweekly, right?
Our advice is usually, Laura, just give it up. Don't bother. Don't
twice
use the
a
word.
Week.
Just put it in a frame and put it on the wall and admire it and just say every other week or every 2 weeks and move on or twice a week. Just avoid all confusion that way.
All right. Okay. If she really wants to. Martha, do you have a rule or no?
No, there's no rule. Except you're just going to have to explain it every time. That's the problem with it. You're going to have to say biweekly. And by that, I mean.
Right. Yeah. There's really no way around it except a word around it.
All right.
You're always going to have somebody show up at the wrong time.
Excellent. Thanks for that call, Laura. Peter joins us now in Milwaukee. Peter, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, I have a couple of comments and then a quick question. So I think I actually have a couple of new words for you to consider, but I'll give you those at the end to keep you.
We just got a little bit of time. Hit us with your main thing, Peter.
The main thing I wanted to talk about is the diminution of the language related to what people think are new words but are really incorrect usages, and also adding words that don't make any sense at all. So your guest mentioned the concept of oat milk. Well, I'm from Wisconsin. I come from a dairy family. And I know for a fact that milk is the food product created by the mammalian class of animals and not some juice of a fruit or vegetable, okay?
Peter, so, I got you. We're just about out of time. Language is, you mentioned oat milk was added to the dictionary here. Language can be contentious. Who wants to bring us out with that?
Yeah, but more than one thing. Just, for example, that meat, the word M-E-A-T, those same cows give us meat. Meat used to mean all food, not just the muscle matter. So, and what about the, you know, the... When you read the Bible, milk is used to mean more than milk of the cow. Huh. So there's lots of things that milk can mean.
All right. And Martha, 30 seconds, a trend you're watching for in new word creation.
Oh, boy, a trend I'm watching for. It's not exactly new word creation, but somebody told me the other day that they liked my drip. And I said, what?
Oh, yeah, that was a high compliment, Martha. You must have been really styling.
Well, I figured out eventually that it was a compliment because it's a word, of course, that we've known historically to mean, you know, drops falling. But if you like somebody's drip, you like how they're styling. Yeah, how they're dressing. It's like they're dripping with diamonds. But that's something I heard from a 20-something, and I was very happy once I actually learned the meaning of that word.
No one has ever said that to me. Thanks to our guests today, Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, co-hosts of Away with Words. Check them out Sunday mornings at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Keep sharing your favorite words. Email ideas@wpr.org.